Hello, everyone. I'm Nate Truax, and you're listening to the CrocCast Podcast. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to CrocCast Podcast. I'm your host, Nate. And today I'm joined by Rupert of Rupert's Reptiles. Rupert, welcome to the show.
Thank you, man. Very happy to be here.
So, Rupert, you want to get us started off on how you first got into reptiles?
Yeah, sure. It's a very easy story. I was always a wildlife guy ever since I was a kid. My parents and even my parents' parents were into wildlife. My grandfather was surveying Viperiberus adders on the Gower in Wales, even like throughout his whole life. So that was always in my family. But because reptiles aren't so common, definitely not easy to find in the UK if you don't have like the knowledge, I was always more of like an invertebrates guy. And then my parents whipped me up on a little trip abroad. I mean, we went to South Africa first. And around then, I started seeing my first snakes in the wild, just stumbling into them. And ever since then, I was just totally captivated. And it started off kind of in tandem with other wildlife interests and then progressively just built and built and built and became more of like a focus over time until it was really the only thing.
Okay. And I know you through your YouTube. I'm guessing that's how most people know you through YouTube. You want to get started? Tell us how you got started on YouTubing your reptile adventures.
I was making YouTube videos when I was like 12, 13 years old with reptiles. You know, I started filming them so early. I've always been like incredibly passionate about like content creation, even before I knew that was a thing. Like when I was a kid, I just loved taking pictures, loved making videos, loved putting stuff out on the internet. Some of those like videos when I was a 12, 13 are still out there somewhere. And I kind of went off that for a long time. And like many people in the herp community, got more a bit more camera photography focused. And sometime around, I think it was 2019, early 2020, I was watching like NKF herping videos. And I remember being inspired by how he was able to make them so interesting without like over sensationalizing the content. And I was like, hey, I want to give that a shot. That looks really fun to start making some videos. Started filming them in 2020. And I've just tried to keep it pretty consistent since then.
Yeah. And from what I saw of your videos, you mostly seem to be herping in Southeast Asia. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yeah. The video started off in Europe. I filmed my first however many in Europe because I was living there at the time and it was COVID, so I couldn't travel. But I already had the plans in motion to move to Southeast Asia in 2022. So the second that rolled about, I've lived in Southeast Asia ever since. So obviously all my content has been based there. And that's where I was focused on herping before that point as well. My backstory in that is basically I traveled to a lot of places with my parents when I was younger and when I was a kid and herped in all these different areas. And the most places I like the most were definitely Southeast Asia, so Thailand, Malaysia, and North America. And I'd say just the species and snakes in Southeast Asia slightly outweighed the ones in North America in terms of their personal interest to me. Plus the fact that is mainly, I guess, the fact that that area is so undiscovered and so unexplored at the time. And I really got a real sense of like exploration and discovery, finding stuff there. And, you know, so often you'd find things even when I was just a kid and it would be like a range extension because there was so little data out there. And I kind of became addicted to that. And you know how it is. The more you get into something, the more you get into it from that point. And it was like Southeast Asia was what I always wanted to build on and build on and build on. And of course we had our concept for Explore Herpetology. And that was what we did when we moved out to Southeast Asia in 2022.
Yeah. You mentioned Explore Herpetology. You want to tell us what that is?
Yeah. So Explore Herpetology is like kind of like a collective of herping experts. The main thing we do is provide herping expeditions, so tours, short and long form, primarily long form private trips and group expeditions focusing on Southeast Asia. So everywhere like Laos, Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, Borneo, all those places are on our calendar, as well as Philippines as well. Yeah, Philippines. And we just specialize in like high value, high quality herping expeditions, which with in all those different regions. That was the concept we originally had. We started it in Thailand because that was the area that me and the guys who started the company with knew the best. And since then, we've just worked incredibly hard, all based ourselves in Southeast Asia, and have tried to like branch out and hit as many different areas as possible in order to, you know, explore as many areas as we possibly can and find the best things.
Okay. And what would you say, you mentioned Thailand is one you're most familiar with, but what would you say is your most popular destination in terms of bookings?
Definitely Borneo, without a doubt. Like, I've always said this, that Thailand's the best country in Southeast Asia for herping. But the problem with Thailand is, you mentioned Thailand and people associate Thailand with ladyboys and sex tourism and things like that. Whereas you mentioned Borneo, people immediately associate Borneo with like wildlife.
Like orangutans.
Orangutans. People think wildlife, they think jungle. So there's a real like allure for people growing up in the West when it comes to Borneo. Like there's such a, like this area has a lot of clout and a lot of like mythos when it comes to it's. So those trips do really well. Not to mention that the quality in Borneo is just through the roof. Like while the experience there is a little bit more controlled than some of our other expeditions in terms of like, it's all kind of operated within national parks and private areas where we have to have like rangers with us and specific staff. And there's only limited like trail areas you can access. The quality there is just absolutely ridiculous on every trip.
Yeah. I might actually be going to Malaysian Borneo next August. So
sounds good, man.
Yeah. I have a friend over there who's a Temesuma researcher. So he invited me out there. So look forward to doing that.
Alex, that will be really, really good. Yeah, just hit me up if you need any spots or some advice.
I might do that, because what I might do is fly into Kuala Lumpur first and maybe take a day or two trying to herp around there. So I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how good the herping is around Kuala Lumpur. So
that's where I'm based out of. That's where I live for most of the year is Kuala Lumpur.
Okay.
And the herping is pretty good. Like we can find, it's maybe like, I think there's like, there's more than 80 species of snake recorded from the city itself.
Wow. So
it's pretty diverse, actually. Yeah, we find a red-headed crate just on the edge of town, right by my house.
Oh, yeah, I saw that on your Instagram story a few weeks ago, right?
Yeah.
Another redhead crate?
Yeah, yeah. We found a lot of, like, crazy stuff. You know, a lot of people herp around KL. There's a few other like very experienced herpers who spend time there. It's an amazing place. Like the city's just crazy. You get there and like basically from everywhere on the, let's say, the eastern and northern part of the city, you can just see hills and forests all around. Like where I live on the eastern part, like literally is just the city on one side and the other side of my house just jungle as far as the eye can see. There's huge mountain ranges going off. So pretty much all the species, including mammals like leopard and stuff, can just be found on the edge of the city. So it's a pretty cool place.
Yeah. And well, I'm a sucker for the basics thing. So I would really love to see one of those Malaysian Peninsular King Cobras, the Bungarus. Because aren't those the largest species of King Cobras?
Yeah, yeah. Ophiophagus bungarus is the largest recorded species. Southern Thailand, a lot of like very, very large individuals come from Southern Thailand. And but I wouldn't consider that so much a simple target. I consider that a very, very challenging target. I'd say Ophiophagus bungarus in Borneo or the mainland, so southern Thailand, Peninsular Malaysia or Sumatra, like incredibly difficult snake to target. It's not that it's necessarily rare, but it's just so secretive, so elusive, and very, very difficult to find compared to some of the other species of King Cobra.
Okay. What has been your experience? Well, you mentioned that they're difficult to find, but what's your experience with the other species of Ophiophagus?
Well, I've never seen any except the like two ones that occur in the like mainland of Southeast Asia. So Hanna and Bungarus. I think I've seen them like equal amount of times. I think I've seen them like 5 times each. Maybe I've seen Bungarus 6 times. I'd have to count it up, which I'm not going to do now, which isn't that many considering how long I've been herping out here in the region. I would put that down to the areas that I go the most. I think a lot of the places I spent the most time herping haven't been the best for finding King Cobra per se. And obviously we mostly herp at night. Like we very heavily search at night, at least in yesteryear. Recently we've been getting a few more King Cobra observations because we do a lot more in the daytime. But yeah, I've seen them each a few times. I've been to Philippines where the other species occur, yet to see them so far. You know, there's like there's the Salvatana, which is the North Philippine one. And right now there's one in the southern part of the Philippines, which we just call Ophiophagus CF bungarus or Ophiophagus spa, because that one looks totally different to bungarus and it wasn't surveyed. It wasn't like sampled at all for the paper. So there's a very high chance that's another like undescribed one down there as well. Yeah. That's one of my biggest targets for sure. We're going to the Philippines, Mindanao in January. And trust me, that one is right up there at the top of the agenda.
Yeah. So I'm kind of a crocodilian guy myself. South Asia has kind of underappreciated diversity of crocodilians. You obviously have well, muggers are more South Asia, but you have the siamensis, which I know can be like hen's teeth finding those. Aforementioned Temistina, salties, and then Philippine crocs.
Yeah.
How many of those have you seen in the wild?
Zero.
Not even salties?
I'm not a croc guy. No, I'm not a croc guy at all, actually. I think Thomas Stomer is amazing. I think that croc is really, really cool. But I am first and foremost a snake guy, and all my pursuits are really like snakes and lizards, first and foremost. And
something that won't drag into the water and eat you.
It's not just that. It's also that a lot of these crocs are like highly protected out here. You can't just like go and wrangle them in the field. Like there are spots, and some of the guys in our team have been to the places where you can see siamensis, and they've got pictures of those. But of course, in those areas, they're like strictly protected. You can't go near them or disturb them. And I'd love to go to like some Thomas Stomer sites. So I mean, in the Southern Thailand, like there was Thomas Stomer recorded from Southern Thailand, the peat swamp in the Ratiwap, but it hasn't been recorded since like 1970, I think. But we still believe they're there, and we have looked for them, like we have eye shine for them. But it's a really like ultra protected area, and you can't just go in on the boat at night. Like you can't do that. So
yeah. Okay.
So I believe they're there. I don't think they're extinct. I think they're still there. The locals say they're still there. So.
Well, local knowledge is usually the best knowledge, right?
Depends what you're asking about. Sometimes there's like a whole bunch of species are considered one thing and can be like convoluted, but I trust them on this front.
Yeah. So going back to snakes and lizards, in Kuala Lumpur, what would you say is the most common species you find?
Damn. Like either like the Asian vine snake, Hatala prasina, or the painted bronzeback. Those are just really predictable. Like the painted bronzeback is like so common if you shine certain places at night because they sleep on like grasses on the edge of the forest. And in terms of looking in the forest at night, it's a good question. Once you get into the jungle, it's really just kind of a toss up. There's a really big rat snake called the white-bellied rat snake, which is also common to find at night. There's a whole host of other snakes as well.
Is that a Gonyosoma?
No, it's a TS. So TS fusca, white-bellied rat snake. Gonyosoma is not really common around KL. I don't see it very often at all, but it is there. Definitely is there.
Okay. All right.
But just these like arboreal snakes that sleep at night, there's certain places where they can be really abundant. But herping in KL is not herping in Southeast Asia, especially tropical Southeast Asia in general, is not a high density herping experience. A lot of nights you're working with a species. This is me personally. Okay. I'm working with a species count of, let's say, 3 to 6. And if you don't have the experience that I do, you might be really struggling to get to 3. So that's the kind of like vibes. So once you get past like the 2 most common species, everything's kind of just a mix up of like certain tiers of commonness, you know, and of course seasonality and stuff affects what's showing up as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I never herped in Southeast Asia. I've only herped in tropically in Central America. And I can't say from my experience hiking at night, you do tend to spot the arboreal stuff a lot more than the terrestrial stuff.
Yeah, for
sure. Maybe because that eye level is easy to look up and you can actually like see the underbelly or something like that helps.
Yeah, yeah, that's absolutely. Yeah. And it's just terrestrials are secretive as well. You got to remember that terrestrials are secretive and arboreals are, they're sleeping in places that they consider to be hidden. But of course, when you've got a flashlight shining at night, they just light up amongst the vegetation. So like, especially in the early days, still to this day, there's a lot of nights where we can see like 10 to 20 snakes in a night, like a really good night of herping. They'll all be arboreals, like almost everyone. It's pretty common, actually. But terrestrial snakes, I always consider to be a little bit of a novelty to find at night.
Yeah. In terms of lizards, what do you normally find?
Well, I don't want to really talk about the normal ones because they're really boring. I guess water monitor is the one which people like the most. Like when I bring people out who are new to Southeast Asia and we find a big monitor lizard like sleeping at night or active in the daytime, that's always like really fun. Clouded monitor as well. Varanus nebulosus are kind of like two of my personal favorites. But like lizard diversity in Southeast Asia is not super high, and especially in like any given area, And especially in like slightly degraded forests, like there's not too many lizard species living in the average like mid to mid-level quality forest. Because you know, you have like most forests in Southeast Asia, I guess applies most of the world. Most forests are logged, right? Or at least selectively logged. And there's a lot of regrowth. There's a lot of like secondary forests. There's a lot of selectively logged forests. And it's only really when you get to the primary forest that the real like good lizards start showing up, or the high quality selectively logged forests, which are in really more remote areas. And that's where you can find like incredible stuff like Gonocephalus abbotii, which is like this huge helmeted agamid lizard, which can be bright green or red. And there's like a Dumeril's monitor, the roughneck monitor, are two of my favorites. I'm not, again, like crocs, I'm not a huge like monitor fanatic, but those two rare monitors, Dumerili and roughneck ridicolis, are some of my favorite lizards to find in the wild, and I don't mind getting hands on with them.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned how you almost need a pristine habitat to get that boost in lizard diversity. I guess lizards are a lot more susceptible to the loss of like microhabitats and habitat diversity than some snakes are.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I couldn't tell you the specific science of it, just some of the best lizards, they tend to prefer the more remote or high quality forest areas. Whereas like the selectively logged forests in Southeast Asia, they have the vast majority of the serpentine diversity within them. Like there's not much of a drop off. There's only a few very, very specific species which don't live in selectively logged forests, like snake wise. The number one being like the Sumatran pit viper, which is like, I don't know if you're familiar with that one.
Not particularly. Is that a Trimerosaurus?
Yeah, Trimerosaurus sumatranus. It's this giant, like the females are from the mainland. They're like black and green, spotted like all over. Okay. And the ones from Borneo were like black and yellow spotted.
Okay, that's like,
Yeah. That's one of my like absolute favorite species. And the reason one of the reasons I like that one so much is because it's so incredibly rare. I mean, we would, looking at its like historical distribution compared to like what we know its distribution to be now based on like civilian records and herpa records, and that species in the mainland, like mainland Southeast Asia, has had like a 95% like habitat like or range reduction due to like selectively logging. And because it's a snake and they're incredibly difficult to find in the first place, difficult to survey, like it just gets completely ignored. It now only occurs in one, like a couple tiny fragmented pockets, basically, which are hard to get into, or they're on the edge of extinction, basically, in most of these areas. That's like the main snake, which I think is the most impacted by like habitat destruction.
Hmm.
It seems like if you take the big trees out of the forest and it gets dehumidified in any way, because you know, when you know, selectively logged forests, they only take the biggest, most valuable trees, and a lot of larger trees remain. But once you take those most valuable dipterocarp trees, it just leads to a loss of like understory humidity. And that loss of understory humidity seems to lead to like respiratory issues. That's the theory, which causes this species to gradually die out if it's like in those forests for a long time after.
Oh, so this is a species that is very sensitive to humidity levels then.
Yeah, incredibly sensitive. There's only one place now today in the mainland of Southeast Asia where it has like an even relatively strong population. And that is without a doubt the highest quality forest I have ever been to. You know, every step you take in the jungle there's a giant tree. Some parts of it are logged, but the majority of the area is untouched. And that's good enough. If there's like a mixture of like selectively logged places, they were selectively logged like 100 years ago as well, so it's like they had a long time to regrow, and then there's huge sections which have never been touched by a tractor or anything like that, then they seem to survive there well. But that's it. Other than that one protected area, they're basically just hanging on in a few areas in Peninsula Malaysia which are still being logged to this day. So
Okay, and this is what we say, that's like an arboreal or semi-arboreal species.
Yeah, it's like a typical Trimerosaurus. So it lives most of its life arboreally, but it hunts really low to the ground. So generally,
More like an understory species.
Yeah, but they'll often be ambushing with that. Say this is the ground here. Their head will be like here, basically. Huh. And sometimes they sit on like roots in the ground. And we got pictures of them like sitting on low logs. They're generally like close to the low vegetation. And every now and again, they crawl up above head height and like coil up in the canopy. They're like a low understory species for sure.
Okay. Huh, interesting. And what would say has been, is in your experience, what is the largest threat to the herp diversity in Southeast Asia? And I understand if you say logging right off the bat.
Yeah, it's got to be habitat destruction. I think that's the number one threat to just species worldwide, whatever group you want to talk about. There's a huge difference between, there's many different threats to species, you know, roadkill, over-collection, poaching for whatever means, depending on what area in the world you're looking at, disturbance, you know, whatnot. You know, all those things they can recover from. You can't, a state species can't recover if its habitat's gone and turned into a parking lot, you know, or turned into a plantation. Like, from that point onwards, there's no coming back. And that's why I think that's the number one, like, issue very clearly, because once the habitat's gone, once you chop those big trees down, which are like hundreds and hundreds of years old, the way that the forest grows back afterwards makes those kind of trees almost very, very difficult to grow back from that point. So it's almost like, you know, it's almost impossible to regenerate to the quality that it once was.
Yeah. Yeah. It takes a long time for those forests. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but doesn't Southeast Asia have like the oldest tropical forest in the world?
I believe so. Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely.
So
I think Malaysia.
And out of your experience, which country would you say is the most impacted by this habitat loss?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I haven't been everywhere, and I obviously don't have like a complete mental topography map of like how the habitat's changed.
Yeah, I wasn't saying you were an expert like geocaster player or something like that, but
I'm pretty good at that. But I think I'd like to say like certain parts of Indonesia. Probably, unless I'm missing something. Oh no, Vietnam as well has had a lot of habitat loss. They still got some like large areas of primary forest though, I think, remaining in Vietnam.
Yeah.
It's really hard to say. A lot of places are in the same boat, I'd say. Certain islands in Indonesia, like Java, for example, have had most of the habitat like gone. It's mostly just secondary or selectively logged forest in even the tiny pockets it remains. You know, that's an island with a giant population.
Yeah. And it's not even that large an island either.
Yeah, it's not that big. It's one of the greatest sundas, but definitely that one is
Sumatra. It's not Borneo. Yeah.
In terms of like its size, because there's obviously other small islands in Southeast Asia which have had like every tree chopped down basically to make way for other things. But in terms of like a large area, I think Java and Indonesia, and Indonesia as a whole has chopped down a lot of places. But fortunately, Indonesia is a very big place, and there's a lot of very, very remote places there. Like certain parts of Sulawesi and Kalimantan and Borneo are completely like untouched. So for certain areas like Java that have lost a lot, there's also other areas that still hold a lot of high quality diversity.
Yeah. And this kind of ties into my next question, which is, which has been your favorite country to go herping in Southeast Asia?
Oh man, that's just such a hard question to answer, because it changes like year by year. Like I go through phases of being really, really into one place and then really into another. I think overall, like the place that's the closest to my heart is Thailand, because it's the place I spent the most time. I've seen the most stuff there. And generally the culture and infrastructure in Thailand is incredibly friendly to herping. And maybe partially that's because I have so much experience. I speak a bit of the language and find it a very easy place to navigate travel. It feels similar to, I guess, if you travel around like the United States, and it feels more like incredibly comfortable, familiar. I know what's going on. I know everything about it. I think that's why I prefer that one the most. But recently I've been more into places like the Philippines, which have certain things I love about the culture there. I love the fact that most people speak English there. It makes traveling around and even remote places very like easy. I love how undiscovered it is, unexplored. I love how friendly the people are there. I love the general vibe there. It's very chaotic, but I find it fun. And I love the like species there. So I think Philippines right now is the place I've had the most interest in, even though I haven't been able to get out there anywhere near as much as I would have liked.
All right. And what do you say is some of your favorite species you've found in all your years of herping?
Oh, man. Let me see. I've got like a solid like top five, I think. It always like mix and matches. I found this one of my all-time favorites was I road cruise in northern Thailand, this snake called the black striped green rat snake. It's kind of a long common name. But T.S. Nigra marginata is the binomial, Pitthais C.F. Nigra marginata. And it's like it was 3 meters long, right? So I think we measured it in at 296 centimeters or something like that. And it's ridiculous. It's got like a yellow golden head, a bright green upper body, which is golden in the midsection, going to a black and white striped tail. And it was just, you know, the species is not only incredibly rare, restricted to this tiny corner of Thailand. And of course, that species occurs in southern China, India, where it's much more common, but it's different there, right? It's a lot smaller in those areas and it looks slightly different and the juveniles look different. So we perceive this to be like a different clade, probably a different species entirely within that group. And this one, which occurs in northwestern Vietnam, northern Laos, and northeastern Thailand, is incredibly difficult to find, like so hard to find in the wild that there's barely any photographs of it. And nobody, no like Western herper, that's one, no herper had ever caught like an adult individual before in Thailand. And it wasn't just that that made it special. It was just how incredible that snake looked. It was definitely one of the wildest encounters I ever had in my life. And it's been what something I dreamed of for so many years after I first saw the first ever pictures of that species on that very road. A couple people had taken pictures of them like on the edge of the road, like crossing and stuff, like just random people who spotted them from their like car window. And I remember seeing it myself was just an unbelievable experience. But another one, which was just a truly like unbelievable encounter, was the, what we call so far, we call it the Sulu temple viper, right? Chopper the lamus CF subannulatus. And this was like one of the things we planned for such a long time. We went to this incredibly remote part of the Philippines, which was previously occupied by a terrorist cell who were claimed by ISIS themselves, by the way. So it was like a Moro separatist group that was responsible for the most deadly terrorist attacks ever in the Philippines. And they made international news several times. They kidnapped and executed some millionaires from Canada and stuff like that. So it was a really sketchy area. But in the recent years, their group has basically become defunct. They got like ousted by the CIA and the Philippine military, like took them out gradually. And we jumped at the first opportunity at seeing that this area would be relatively safe to go to and go and look for this crazy viper. You guys can see it on my YouTube and my Instagram. This viper, it's like a huge pit viper. It's really fat. And it's like bright yellow on the underside and black the whole way down the top with like very thin yellow bands. It looks totally different to any other in the Chopper the Lamus subannulatus group. And we showed up, and in the very first like 15 minutes of searching for it, in this crazy scenario where these guys picked us up in this van, drove us out to the middle of nowhere, zero cell bars, and they were carrying like handguns and machetes, these guys we went with, right? We just found them on Facebook, by the way. Just picked up these guys on Facebook. They took us to the mosque and then took us straight out herping. And because the guy had seen it in his like property before, we went out there and we found it in the first 15 minutes, a giant 90-something centimeter gravid female. That was definitely one of my favorites.
Oh, man, that's got to be quite the herping trip. It's like, well, got our target 15 minutes in, wrap it up, we can't talk.
Yeah, that was actually what we did. We were actually just like, yeah, let's wrap it up. We spent a while with the snake, like we did a few like measurements and whatnot, and we took all our photos, and we did like, there was like 20 guys there, like local guys, a lot of them like farm workers, and some of them from the, like, I don't know how to describe this, these guys, they're, I don't really know how to describe them. They like do community stuff there in this island of Tawi Tawi. And they're like community leaders. These are the people that we found that like took us up. They're like Islamic Muslim community leaders. And we like spent ages like talking to them about the snake and whatnot and like educating them about that thing. And then after that, we just were like, all right, let's go. And then made those guys take us, get some food, and just hung out like for the rest of the time in the island. Yeah. That was one of the craziest trips I ever did, because like we were told like, do not go there. Like everybody was like, it's too dangerous. It's too dangerous. Like you can't go there. Like white people, do not go to this area. Like you're going to be an easy target. But we did a lot of like, well, I did a lot of research. Keith did a lot of research. I was the complete opposite. I didn't want to do any research because I didn't want to scare myself off going. That was the thing. I didn't want to read about any kidnappings or any horrific things. I was like, I just want to focus on the mission. I don't want to have any of that crap clouding my mind. And when we finished the trip, I was like, okay, now I'm going to read the articles. And I read these like giant, like really in-depth stories about the history of that area. And some of the stuff they did to some people they kidnapped was absolutely horrendous. And if I'd have read that before I went, man, I'm telling you, I would have had second thoughts, no doubt about it.
As the old saying goes, ignorance is bliss.
Yeah. I was really running that meta. That was exactly my thinking beforehand. I was like, I don't want to be spooked at all. I just want to focus.
You don't want to be so jumpy that you leap 10 feet in the air when someone says hi to you.
Well, that's the thing, man. We did not know these guys. This guy posted a picture of the snake from his farm a few days before, right? And Keith was trying to contact him, and this guy wouldn't answer Keith's messages. So Keith just started spam calling this guy until he finally picked up the phone. And the guy was like, oh yeah, sorry, sorry. The signal's really bad here on this island. I'll contact you soon. And we told him what was going on. And he was like, yeah, yeah, you guys just come by. I'll pick you up. And he was just like, I'll pick you up from your place. They show up in a repurposed like ambulance. They've been gifted an ambulance for during the COVID era from the government. It was a converted Toyota Hilux, basically. And they just loaded us into the back of this van. We did not know these guys whatsoever. And they were and this guy had a gun like tucked into his waist as well. And so did his friend. And I remember I looked at Keith and we looked at each other, and Keith would not acknowledge the gun. He was like, you realize like once we go, like that's it. And I was thinking for a second, I was like, I get a good vibe from these guys. I was like, I get a good vibe. I think we should do it. And we like shook hands. We were like, let's go. And we proved to be right. They were awesome.
Sweet. Some guys in a repurposed refab truck with a bunch of guns and a good vibe.
Yeah.
That's just Texas. That's just Texas.
We call it like a Far Cry 3 vibe, you know, with like the tropical island. There's like palm trees everywhere. It's like a tropical island with a tiny like island surrounded by the most like clear blue ocean you'll ever see in your life. It's like actual tropical paradise, like sandy beaches, palm trees everywhere. Jump in the back of the truck, got guns, got machetes. Let's go. Let's make it happen.
Yeah, the only reason I'll go there if I had the same healing mechanic as Far Cry 3. Just pull a couple fingers and your arm's completely fixed.
I've seen that area is actually like they started building a ton of resorts on that island, because I'm still friends with the guys there, and we talk to them every now and again, and there's a bunch of new resorts open. They're really trying to push the like tourism there. It's mostly just Filipino people that go there. I think Westerners, all the Western governments, like it's a red zone, right? And no insurance company will cover you if you go there, like zero, yeah. Big fat zero. But if you're willing to take that L, I'd say it's like an incredible holiday destination, like truly top tier.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's going to be, if I was to book a vacation to Al-Qaeda HQ, I'd have a hard time imagining State Farm would cover me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like that in a lot of places, though. Like Thailand's deep south is similar, actually. Like the deep south of Thailand, the most southern provinces have been like a conflict zone for a very long time. And even though like the vast majority of it is completely safe and has been for a long time. And when there is violence today, it's very, very rarely fatal. It's just a little bit of scattered here and there things to like store up trouble and keep the like state of emergency going down there. But it's still, despite that, like Western governments will not cover you for insurance wise, even though like the whole thing is basically 100% safe.
Yeah. Yeah. So back in April, me and a couple of buddies of mine went down to Colombia for a week, and to go to Colombia, I had to fill out a form, basically fill out a form with the embassy, where the embassy keeps sending email notifications. So it apparently going to be getting these emails for like the next rest of the year into next year, just safety updates about Colombia. It's like, oh, that's how I went through. That's marked as a dangerous area. We should not have gone to.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Oh, well.
Yeah, it's a lot of this stuff is out. I mean, the governments are incredibly cautious. Like, let's bear in mind that Thailand as a whole is a recommended not to travel to place. If you look at any like government recommended thing, you know, and there's a ton of like extremely superstitious, borderline superstitious, like very nervous attitudes towards places, which there doesn't need to be. And for the most part, I don't really pay any attention to that. I go where the good snakes are.
Yeah. So honestly, though, I think most people the world over, when you tell them you're looking for snakes, they're like, oh, I don't want to mess with you then. They just leave you alone. But
yeah, I agree. Tell people you're looking for snakes. They don't want anything to do with snakes. So it's a good recipe. Good
yeah.
Recipe, being left alone.
Yeah. So what are there some places in Southeast Asia that you haven't gone herping to yet that you want to go herping to?
I think like Myanmar is the number one place that I want to go. It's the only like mainland Southeast Asian country I haven't visited. And obviously it's been an actual war zone. We're not talking like these fake war zones that I've just been talking about, like Southern Thailand, Tawi Tawi, etc. Like those places are like, okay, a bit of scattered here and there, little bit of separatist activity going on. No, it's like thousands and thousands, like tens of thousands of people, like civilian people have died in Myanmar in recent years. It's like a full scale civil war going on there. And there's also a curfew, which means if you even got into there to go herping, you have to stop by 10 p.m., which isn't ideal. And it's just in general, just like not an easy place to go. And some of the best places, the places I most want to go, are some of the most like currently, like there's a lot of trouble going on there. So I'm just waiting until that can hopefully find a peaceful solution. And then that's the first place I want to step.
Yeah. You mentioned the curfew, which is actually an interesting question I had, is based off your experience, what's the best time of day or night for herping in Southeast Asian tropical environment?
I'd say like from twilight to like 2 hours after dark, I'd probably say is like the, but it really depends on the day, the time, the weather cycle. It could be incredibly hard to predict, but I had kind of developed certain like methods and strategies over time to maximize value. And one of my like go-tos that I do no matter what is get out at twilight, like this, like ideally right before it gets dark, like the end of sunset, and be herping from that point, and make sure you hit the first 2 hours of the night, because a lot of the time that's a fantastic window. But, you know, there's other species like Malcolm's pit viper, and that's one we target a lot on our Borneo trips, which I tend to find more of like a late night mover. So a lot of the early parts of the night, I actually started getting out a bit later there when herping in those areas, because a lot of the time I find them moving after like 11, even midnight in that area. Seems to be more of their window when it gets colder.
Okay. And daytime is mostly just lizard, maybe some large lizards you see or something like that. Not much movement during the daytime.
There's a lot of snake movement. It's just very hard to find it. It's very hard to cross paths with it, because, you know, the diurnals are incredibly hard to find in the daytime, because you don't have the advantage of shining them with a flashlight. And plus, they're not coiled up. They're moving around. A lot of them, I think, go higher in the trees or go into like really dense areas. And a lot of diurnals are terrestrial as well. Like the diurnals, which are moving around in places like on the ground, are just as secretive as the ones are at night. So finding snakes in the daytime in Southeast Asia, I don't know if you've tried in South America. Have you been looking for snakes in the daytime in South America?
A little bit. Pretty much no success. So
Yeah. It's more or less like that. There's certain areas where we've developed like strategies or found places, and definitely the weather makes a huge impact. So if it's like a really overcast day and there's like good UV coming through the clouds, or not too much UV, maybe, let's say, but it's like a thick low cloud level and everything's like diffused, that is like get out on the road and start cruising right now, because those days you only get them a few times per year, and you will find snakes on the road in the daytime if you go out in those conditions. Like we did a trip just a couple of weeks ago in Peninsula Malaysia with some clients from the US, and we had one single day when the weather was like that, and we got out cruising. We got king cobra, Goniosoma oxycephalum, and a kukri snake all in the daytime on the road, which is crazy, by the way. That's like, it's like one of the best days. And we found a cave racer like sitting on the edge of out just outside a cave in like a window. So a four snake species day in Southeast Asia. I've only done that a couple times in my life, by the way. So that's the kind of thing you can make happen if you have that kind of weather.
Yeah. And that brings my second question is, what would say is your preferred balance between hiking and road cruising?
Really just depends on the area, depends on my mood. In Northern Thailand, you're talking a 90-10 in favor of road cruising. I think like road cruising is just so much better for finding the high value, like the species you really want to encounter, like what we call the showstopper species. Whereas in the South, I'd probably be talking like a 60-40 or 70-30 in favor of hiking. In the more tropical areas. In Borneo, I'd be doing a 90-10 in favor of hiking, like 90% hiking, 10% road cruising. It's not necessarily because of the productivity of the road cruising, it's more like the quality of the roads. So in Borneo, where we are, we do a bit of road cruising there, but the roads aren't that good for cruising, and hiking tends to turn up our targets much more often. Whereas in Northern Thailand, it's like an Indochina, a lot of parts of Indochina, like Southern China, North Vietnam, places like that, like road cruising definitely is a good meta in the areas where it's possible.
Yeah. Oh, so you say like the more northern parts of Indochina have better road infrastructure?
No, China has fantastic road infrastructure. In China, the meta is more so like road walking seems to be like the primary method of finding snakes in China. It's can be quite similar in the highlands of Peninsula Malaysia as well. It's very interesting. In the lowlands, like the tropical forest, Borneo, Peninsula Malaysia, definitely hiking in the forest, like trails and stream sides is very good. Whereas in the highlands, we always find the roadsides to be a lot more productive than ever stepping foot on the trails. And I've yet to really find a reason why.
Okay. So outside of Southeast Asia, what are some other places you have gone herping around the world?
Not many places, honestly. In terms of like being an adult who is conscious of what herping is and can apply myself properly, I think only Europe is really the only place I've been. I've been to a few places in Europe. I have herped in Australia and the United States, but I was like an actual kid then, like an actual child. I was like 13 years old, like just turned 14 when I was in the US. So I was just tagging along with my parents, like flipping logs and trash whenever I could. I'd love to get out to a lot more places. Like I have so many plans of places I want to go. Like I really want to go back to the US and do another trip there. I have so many friends, you know, in the US and people I could say hi to there and places I'd like to go. I like the vibe there. I like the fact there's a lot of road cruising. I like the Sky Islands in Arizona. I really want to go there. I love the southeast of the US, like North Florida, Georgia, that kind of area. I love the vibe there. I just love to go. Same as South America as well, just because it's similar to Southeast Asia, like in terms of the environment, but like every single thing would be a lifer except like green iguana.
Well, hell, you could get those in Miami.
Yeah, you get those a lot of places. Yeah.
You go to Southeast Asia. Yeah, you go to Miami, you get your Southeast Asian, your African, your Latin American herp lifers all in one.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. It was a good time.
Okay. Have you ever gone to, I know Southeast Asia, kind of stereotypical question, but have you ever gone to Komodo?
No, like I said, I'm not that I don't like the stuff that you could find there, but just generally my modus operandi in recent years has been to try to go to places which aren't as frequently traveled by other herpers. So I'm trying to like push the boundaries and push the envelope in terms of like the more remote places you can go, the rarer things that we can find. So it's not that I don't want to go there. It's just I have very limited time that I can do those kind of non-work trips, you know, like personal stuff.
Yeah.
In terms of, and then on those kind of trips, I want to hit some like real targets, some crazy stuff. You know, I want to try and look for some things which haven't been seen in God knows how many years or never been discovered yet. So that's the kind of thing we're on these days.
And have you ever done any herping in, say, the Lesser Sunda Islands? So Sulawesi and east of there.
I've been to Bali, but I had dengue fever while I was there, so I didn't get to do much herping. So that's the only Lesser Sunda I've been to. I was supposed to do a lot more stuff there. At the time, this is a long time ago, by the way. This is like 10 years now, almost 10 years, just a teenager then. But I did some herping there. I prefer the Greater Sundas and Northern and Indochina. Just because like there's so much insane diversity there and like whereas the Lesser Sundas don't tend to have too much like diversity, you know, it's just there's a few cool endemics. I want to go to the Moluccas, if you know those islands.
Yeah.
East of Sulawesi. It's like the kind of bridge between Southeast Asian fauna and Australasian, like Australian fauna.
Yeah.
That would be cool.
I say that because I'm a big scrub python fan, so I always want to see wild scrub pythons.
Yeah, yeah. There's a Halmahera python. My friend saw that just really recently, actually. We were hanging out in Sulawesi, and then he went there afterwards and saw that. I was pretty jealous. I'm not even a big python fan, but that species has not been seen many times, and I like that.
Yeah.
I want to see Bolan's python.
Bolan's? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know a guy who's seen him a couple times in Highlands of New Guinea.
Well, so. The guy, did he do research there?
I think he did a little bit of research, but I had to go re-listen to it. That's like all the way back, like the second episode we had him on. We talked about it, but he mentioned how it got cold up there during the day. You had to wear a sweater up there. So
yeah, for sure. My friend is like really that's like his number one like dream snake to see in the wild, and he's been like hyping me up about that for so long because he wants us to go on a trip there. Personally, like I'm not a super into that idea. One, that area is insanely dangerous and just so I don't know what way to describe that without coming across as offensive. It's just like, it's a crazy place, man. It's like really, really like remote. We're talking like full on tribal control of all the different areas. Everything that's not tribal control is military zones you can't enter. It's just like the level of danger there is ridiculous. Like people are still regularly kidnapped and held to ransom to this day. The infrastructure is just beyond terrible, like beyond terrible. You know, and even though I like going to remote areas, I also just don't like suffering. So area would be a struggle, especially for a snake, which you are not even close to guaranteed to see, like a rare snake.
Yeah. I mean, I love a lot of the herpetofauna that comes out of New Guinea, but when I had Mark O'Shea on, he told me, he's like, yeah, you don't want to go there. Find somewhere else to go. It's just not worth the risk.
So. Yeah, we spoke to him about the trip plan that my friend had. He was speaking to him, and then Chip was like chatting about that and basically got the same advice as that place is scuffed. Stay away. That's the advice.
Yeah. So.
But I got a lot of friends who go to Raja Ampat. Like tons of Herpas go to Raja Ampat these days. That place seems to be like not only safe, but also very accessible. And there's quite a few like herping camps / guides there, which will take you to see the tree monitors. They're really good at finding those, and they'll give you access to the forest at night. The only problem with that area is that like out of the three different groups of people I know who went there, two out of three, at least one person got malaria. So malaria is like, pretty active in that area. And then on another time, my friend Yari went there. He told me that one of the girls in his group got scrub typhus.
I don't know what that is, but that doesn't sound good.
It's not good. It's not as bad as malaria in terms of like, yeah, it's not as bad. It's pretty bad disease, a bad tropical disease. It's spread by those little mites, jungle mites, little red ones. They look like bed bugs, but they live in the forest. You can get scrub typhus in Thailand, Malaysia, but for whatever reason, it's just really, really rare there.
Okay. Huh. Yeah. You mentioned, yeah, once got dengue in Bali and malaria, and now scrub typhus. How much does the risk of these tropical diseases weigh into how you plan trip?
When it comes to like going to Raja Ampat, the fact that the rates of people I know getting malaria there is so high, that massively factors into it for me, because I can't firm that sickness. Like I don't have the time. I'm too busy. I can't afford to miss certain trips that I'm scheduled to do. And therefore, I'd much rather avoid a high chance of malaria. And obviously, the chance of malaria in most of the places I go to, even Sumatra, is like much, much lower, like significantly lower than over there. So in those places, it doesn't factor in at all. I'm just like, let's go, let's run it up. And when it comes to places where it's a lot higher rate, yeah, it does factor in. But there's not really many other diseases, like tropical diseases, you really need to worry about, at least like not like that. Scrub typhus is super rare. It's just don't get bitten by ticks, like protect yourself, or those mites, just protect yourself, protect your ankles with some like rubber boots and tucked in trousers and socks. That'll do pretty well. What's the one? Leptospirosis, you know, the blood disease, which is transmitted through like rat poop in water.
Yeah, I wasn't planning on drinking much dirty water anyway, so.
It's not drinking, it's just don't like walk in the water with like your bare feet and open wounds on your feet, like no cuts. Yeah. I've never had that. I don't think I'm ever going to get that, because usually I don't ever do that, you know, so.
Yeah, I have like
stagnant water.
Yeah, I have a pair of like knee-high waterproof boots that I wear when I'm going tropics, so hopefully that'll keep me safe.
Yeah, those will be great.
Okay. And okay. What's a species that you most want to see in the wild?
I think like my dream snake to see in the wild is probably the like Mangshan pit viper.
That's a solid one right there.
Because I'm a huge pit viper fan. I love the Protobophrops genus, especially like the more rocky landscape dwelling, like larger ones. And it's just an incredible species living in an incredible area, but it's not my number one right now. My number one right now is without a doubt it's called the Omkoi lancehead. It's another Protobophrops species, Protobophrops kelamohu. I would consider it probably the rarest Viper in the whole world in terms of how many people have been looking for it, the quality of people who've been looking for it, and the total amount that have ever been seen, which currently stands as the total number of Caprotobophrops kelemohu found by herpers, like people going out to look for the snakes, like researchers, people like me who are like semi-hobbyists, semi-researchers, stands at one. One juvenile, and the rest of the type series was collected by local people who were trained to catch them by the snake research team in Thailand. And I've been there four times looking for that species, and I have seen a DOR, but that one's...
it's always the DORs you find.
Yeah, man, and that species does not show up DOR very often ever, by the way. So seeing a DOR is a kind of L you can't recover from. And on all the rest of the chips, not a trace, not a smidgen of that species. The habitat's so degraded in that part of the country. Like, I think it's just clinging on in like a few karstic areas hidden away in the jungle. Ultra seasonal, incredibly cryptic. You can just tell by the way it's built that it spends most of its life hiding in rock crevices. Not to mention it's closely related to the new species that we discovered in Laos. Like, very close. It's a sister species, very closely related to that, which we know spends all its time hiding in like rock crevices. So it's like similar to that one, except at least on the Thai side of the border. We don't know if it's found in Myanmar, but we suspect it may be. On the Thai side, where the only place it's known from, there's very little good habitat. There's very, very, very little good habitat there. And I think that contributes massively to why it's so rare.
Yeah.
That's okay. My number one. That's my number one for sure. Protobophrops kelemohu. It's been my number one. It's the last like Thai endemic or Thai native, like big, showy, cool, special species that I haven't seen.
Yeah. That actually, you mentioned the species you found, and kind of had a little bit of a blow up on social media a few weeks back about sample collection and all that. You want to talk about that?
What do you want to know? Yeah, I collect snakes for science. Yeah, I'm not gonna pretend otherwise. I don't do it very often. I only do it if it's a highly like scientifically valuable specimen. And I only do it if I have the connections in the country who can provide the relevant permits, or it's a place where I have them for already. But I have no problem with collecting for science. And I do it so sporadically. It's not like I go around collecting every new record I find, which, by the way, that's the basis of pretty much the whole of North America's incredibly well-documented and researched herpetofauna. It was all done off the back of the collection of thousands and thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of specimens. And Southeast Asia is a very long way back. There's very little specimens existing from Southeast Asia. And if you ask a real scientist, someone who's not me, they'll tell you that you need to be collecting way more, that we need as much like valuable specimens as possible. Of course, there's some people who bring up a really valuable point, is that you don't need like living holotypes anymore because you can create digital holotypes. But the technology to do that just doesn't exist in Southeast Asia. You know, ZSL, like the guys from London Zoo, can do that in Vietnam because they have the technology to do so and the personnel. It's just not realistic, not possible for us out there. And we have to work within the confines that we have. And we work within the frameworks of those countries. So when we collected the Protobophrops flavirostris in Laos, we're doing it with the Laos team under their way of working in their country. And that's the way it's done, okay? It's not like I can just be like, hold on a second, guys. Let's do this in a way that you can't even like get through the paperwork in your country, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not a fan of collecting. I'm not a big fan. I don't like collect. I'm a wild snakes person. That's why I'm not a researcher, even though I have a degree in biology. And I would obviously, that when I was younger, I thought that would be more my path. But I'm definitely a wild. I like to look at snakes in the wild. I like to photograph snakes in the wild. And I like to release snakes afterwards.
Yeah. It's just, and you made a good point that we do need samples for stuff. And it did really strike me as it seemed like more bleeding hearts that were complaining about you actually taking a sample than people who actually had a firm understanding of how science works.
I get it. I do get it. Like, I get why people would be upset over that, for sure. They've just got to understand that there is a vision to it being beneficial for the long-term future of that species. And a lot of people come, they're like, what if it was the last one? What if it's the last one? It's like, don't worry, it's not the last one.
Yeah. And well, if it's the last one, then, well,
it was going anyway.
If it's the last one, well, shoot, sugar, it's not going to live much longer. May as well actually have it preserved for posterity.
Hey, we got the DNA now. We can clone it one day.
Yeah. That's a whole other can of beans, a can of worms, but...
yeah, I'm not into cloning. I don't think that's a realistic future for snake conservation right now.
Yeah. But I was also curious about the species you found. Do you want to talk a little bit about that particular species?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, we just touched on it now. I've kind of been over this a few times in detail, but if anyone hasn't like watched those videos or seen those reels, I'll just quickly recap it now. So the species wasn't like discovered for the first time by me in terms of I wasn't the first person to see it. Like the vast majority of species which are discovered in Southeast Asia, they were originally spotted by a local person who posted a picture online, a tourist, someone who happened to stumble upon the species, just took a picture of a snake, threw it on the internet, like, what's this? They have no idea what it is. And we saw it get posted online and people were like, oh, it's a three-horned scale pit viper, Protovulpix suvosaurum. Took a close look at it, like, that is not a three-horned scale pit viper. It was obvious immediately that it was a new species of snake. And from the outset, you're obviously going to have multiple different groups of researchers who want to find it. And because I'm such a big fan of Protobophorus, because Lao is so close and I was already planning to go to Lao multiple times anyway, I was like, hell, I'm going to collaborate. My guys who we work with on some Thai projects, like the Oligodon speleoserpens description and a couple other things we have in the works, they really wanted to get that first. And they had the contacts. We had the contacts in Lao who could facilitate us making that project happen, like a collaborative thing where the guys in Lao provide the permits and the collection and stuff like that. And we help them out by shipping the sample off to Moscow where it gets the genetics done. And then we have like obviously people like me who are very proficient at the field who can go out and help with sampling. And the first time we went with some of the Lao guys and us and myself and a couple of friends and just didn't see anything. Tons of other people went in between. Several members of the team went at different points. I know some of the Lao guys went, I think, like 7 times, maybe more. They're looking for it, but nobody saw any. So it's obviously a very rare, very challenging snake. But when we were speaking to the locals in May, we had a chat with them because one of our friends, Ked, like speaks fluent in the local language. And they told them that they see it most often at the end of the rainy season. And I had a month off because I'd been guiding tours like crazy in 2024. I had a month off and I was like, I'm heading to Lao and I'm finding that snake no matter what. And the very, very first night I went out into the field, it just showed up on a rock and that was it. We searched with the Lao guys 4 more nights after that. Nothing. Knowing the exact spot. Yeah. Just stumbled across a female on a rock. When I spotted that, I didn't mention that in my review of the best things I ever seen earlier because I knew this would come up later, but that was probably the best moment I ever had, the best feeling, like I cannot compare it to anything else. Like something like that that's so mythical and so meaningful, and to find a new species, let alone a new species of pit viper, let alone a new species of Protobothrops, which is like my favorite genus of snake, is just something I could never have dreamed of. And the fact that we were able to make that dream come to life with the help of the team and publish that paper and I got to write it as well was just incredible. Yeah, it was really like a experience I will never forget. Definitely the pinnacle of my time in herping so far.
Yeah. Okay, I'm gonna be honest, I'm actually kind of blanking on questions at the moment. Is there anything else you would like to talk about?
I can just run up more stuff about that particular encounter, other new species. I can talk about limestone karst formations because that's where that species was found. It was in these like huge limestone karst formations around the town of Van Vieng in Lao. All the other pictures that existed of it were from inside caves. But we checked so many caves, never found an individual. And the local people told us they don't really see it inside caves. So I think because that area is such a popular caving destination, there was a bias whereby because hundreds of tourists go into those caves every day, on the rare occasions where one of those snakes strayed into the cave, it was like almost guaranteed to be spotted and flipped because the kind of tourists that go inside caves, those are the kind of people that wouldn't be afraid of taking a picture of a snake and putting it on the internet. And that turned out to be true. Whereas when it came to actually sampling for the species, I was a strong believer that we had a better chance searching in the along the karst habitat and looking at it in the rocks. And that turned out to be true in the end. And that's been the case for a lot of species, like the new kukri snakes we got from Thailand. We found Oligodon cicadophagus, which was described by a different group of herpers, but we found it before. Yeah. And Oligodon speleoserpens, which me and the team described, was also found the same way, like searching along limestone karst formations. Because it's crazy that in towns like Van Vieng and places like Krabi, you know, these incredibly touristy places that snakes can go undescribed for so long in these areas because they're occasionally sighted, people glimpse it, but no one ever managed to get their hands on them. And especially with those ones, it was like we couldn't figure out why they were so rare until one moment I had a sudden dawning realization that we're searching in the wrong place. I don't think they just live in the forest areas around. They live on the cast themselves, right? So then we dedicated the time to looking inside caves and these steep-like cliffs. And that's how we found them, inside caves and literally climbing on these sheer rock. And they spend their whole life in the crevices of these steep rock walls. And that's how these species, like the pit viper in Van Vieng and like the oligodon in southern Thailand, can be in such well-traveled areas and go undiscovered despite, you know, there was researchers doing massive surveys for reptiles in Van Vieng City like 10 plus years ago. You know, there's several other species of snake and reptile were discovered and described there. And this viper went unseen the whole time, you know. And that's why it's that species and its sister species, Protobophops calamohi, you know, the species I dream of seeing the most. Something about those two just makes them incredibly, incredibly rare. Some two of the rarest vipers in the world, for sure. No doubt about it.
Yeah. What are some other very rare species you've had the privilege of seeing?
Let me think. Because I've seen some great stuff that I can't talk about yet because it's being like worked on in like research papers, which I can't speak of.
Yeah, don't want to taint the paper before it's even published.
Yeah. Exactly. Let me think. I think the South Philippine temple viper, Tropolemus philippensis, which I don't think is that rare, but for whatever reason, it's almost basically never been seen by herpers in the wild before. And I was able to find it like super easily on my first attempt. Again, going to like a sketchy area where you're like not supposed to travel to. But that species was just incredible. Like a really small Tropolemus with the teal blue coloration and the like dragon-like scales on the head. That was a favorite of mine. I've seen a ton of like really, really rare, tiny snakes as well, like here and there about the way, but I'm trying to think of ones which are a bit more interesting.
Ones that pop on the Instagram page a little bit more.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I the ones I like to see the most is those like tiny rare ones, especially the ones where I've spent like 10 plus years in their habitat. Like just on the recent trip I did in Malaysia, we road cruised the species Gongylosum elongicao, the long-tailed ground snake. I've been herping in areas where this snake lives for more than 10 years consecutively, herping in their habitat time and time again. And like only after that long did I finally get a live one on the road. And that just shows you how crazy the biodiversity is in Southeast Asia when, you know, there's species that can avoid you for so long. And I want to speak briefly on the species which I haven't seen, which is like, there's a couple in Southeast Asia which are so mythical. Their status amongst herpers is like on a whole nother level. And it's this one, it's called Xenolaphus ellipsifer. People call it the oscillated brown snake. We sometimes call it the river rat snake for short, because it's this aquatic rat snake that grows to 3 meters long. And it's like crazy looking. It's got like a reddish, golden brown, like kind of reddish brown head. And then a reticulated python, like similar to reticulated python pattern on the body. And it's huge, and this snake has basically never been seen by a herpa, despite the fact it occurs in so many places which are frequented so often, get some of the most herp traffic in Southeast Asia. You know, every now and again, a tourist or a local posts one online, like they stumble across it either on the road, in a drainage ditch, in the forest. But it's one of those species that, for whatever reason, herpers just cannot get their hands on. Like, all the, like, guys who are like me, the really sweaty guys who want to, like, get all the rarest stuff first, you want to find these things, it's like no one can find the snake. And same with the, you know, the royal tree snake. You've probably seen that one post on Instagram, Gonyosoma margaritatum. Now, ridiculous rat snake that's like yellow, blue, crazy combination of like colors. That's another one which has no justification for being as rare as it is, given it has a wide range. Because in Peninsula Malaysia and Borneo, and it's just, yeah, only a few semi-herpers have ever encountered that one. Yeah.
It's almost like those Greek myths where someone tries to avoid their fate and in doing so brings it upon themselves, but more like the inverse of that. It's like, I try so hard, but the snake knows it. The snake only goes for the casuals.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, those species just blow my mind in terms of how rare they can be. But mark my words, I will find both of those. I will. Ideally, see, this year or next
what
year.
What was that river rat snake again? The
Xenolaphus ellipsifer, the oscillated brown snake. Yeah, you should run up a picture of that. It's a crazy, crazy looking snake.
Oscillated rat snake.
Yeah, oscillated brown snake.
Brown snake. Gotcha.
Yeah.
So. Images.
Yeah, go and take a look at that.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of has a coppery coloration on the top of the head.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the ones from the mainland, like Peninsula Malaysia and Southern Thailand, have that crazy, like, bright red head. Whereas the ones in Borneo are a little bit, like, duller in coloration, but they're just as rare there. So I'll take it. I'll take either.
Yeah. And you mentioned, though, that's a riverine species. So from what you know, are they more like a highland species or a lowland species?
I'll give the game up for people who want to look for this. If anyone's listening and you want to go search for this species to get some intel. So from what we've established, they like large rocky streams. So that's a big reason why they're not encountered many often by herpers, because herpers tend to search around smaller streams, smaller, slower flowing streams, ones which are easier to walk along. These like fast flowing, rocky, deeper rivers, especially with really steep valleys in really remote areas. And you can find them from I'd say the peak elevation is probably like 300 to 1,000 meters, but they've been seen at 1,300 and something meters in Mount Kinabalu in Borneo on the Luwagu Trail inside the national park. I think it was about 1,360 meters that record was from. So from lower submontane forest to lowlands, they're found in the lowlands of Brunei. I've seen a picture from there. So a huge habitat range, I'd say most common in the mid hills, and you want to go to some real remote valleys. But I've seen, they don't seem to be too bothered by habitat destruction in terms of that. I've seen some records from Borneo from places where it's all secondary forest, like no primary forest at all, and a lot of like farmland nearby. But it has to be places with minimal disturbance by the looks of things, like quite remote areas of not many humans around, and definitely steep valleys of big rivers, and they hunt fish in the rivers.
Okay. So
there was just a picture posted of one in our Facebook, because we run a Snakes in Malaysia Facebook ID group. Some random just posted a picture of one of those from Perak in Peninsula Malaysia, like just 1 week ago. First time we ever had a record of that species in our group. And it was just sitting in a waterfall in a huge river and a huge waterfall, just sitting in the water with its head raised. Yeah, that's a mythical encounter. I'm telling you, I'm going to put some real work into turning that one up in the near future.
Yeah. But yeah, you mentioned how its habitat kind of selects it away from most herpers looking for it, just because it's like the place most herpers don't go is where
you've got to like put two and two together a lot of the time. That's what it came down to with when it came to finding those new species that we got in Thailand and Laos. Was about like thinking, why hasn't this species been found before? Why is it so difficult to find? And then addressing it from there. And there's always a reason, right? Especially when it comes to species which aren't just like 24/7 fossorial dwellers, right? So one like this, which has no reason to be not seen as often because of how big it is, it's going to occur in places where people don't go. So all you've got to look at is where people don't go, and then put all the records together and create kind of a tapestry of knowledge based off that. And it's the same with the royal tree snake as well, Gonyosoma margaritatum. That species is without a doubt a high canopy dweller, which is outcompeted by Oxy in most of its range and prefers like really high quality remote primary rainforest where Oxy maybe is not as abundant. Yeah. So it's like one is going to be a high canopy dweller that's in these deep rainforest areas where it doesn't have to compete as much with Gonyosoma oxycephalum. And the other is going to be in these really remote rocky streams where people can't walk around because the boulders are too big, the water's too deep. There's always a reason when it comes to these kind of things. But for some like blind snakes and stuff like that, it's just like this snake spends all its life underground. You're screwed, man.
Yeah.
You don't even try.
Yeah. With blind snake, can you say it's kind of the same principle that applies to shield-tail snakes?
Yeah. Yeah, but blind snakes, I see it even more like fossorial than shield-tails. You know, shield-tails, they earthworms, right? And they spend a lot of time beneath leaf litter, but they do come out on the surface quite often. And but whereas blind snakes, they eat like termite larva, ant larva. So they're like subterranean the majority of the time. So there's like very limited windows where they come above ground for whatever reason, where you might have a chance of getting them. And that's why like blind snakes are always some of those ones that have been seen like once, twice ever in their history. And that's a pain in the ass to track down.
Yeah, honestly, mostly, I'm guessing most of the time it's because when people like digging up something in their yard or something like that, and just like, oh, that worm looks a little different than normal.
If you can dig it up in your yard, it's not that rare, okay? It's, yeah. It's the deep jungle-dwelling species, which are the ones which are always going to be, like, just so incredibly rare. There's some species which are just, like, ghosts, you know? There's a species called Oligodon jinkatunai, or jintakunai. Jintakunai, it's a kukri snake from southern Thailand. One specimen ever collected from an ambiguous location in Krabi, never seen again, you know?
Mm.
Not even a blind snake. That's a terrestrial snake. So yeah, we've got our theories as to where that one lives, but because it's always about trying to figure out if it hasn't been seen, why is it? Is it extinct? No. Is it 24/7 for surreal? No. Then where are people not looking? That's where you're going to find it.
Yeah. Man, there's got to be so many just hidden species that people probably know about, just never know about, especially like deep undisturbed habitat fossorial species that we'll never know anything about.
I reckon there's tons of species left to be discovered in Southeast Asia. I mean, with the amount of ground that humans cover, and especially the adoption of smartphones and social media, I'd say the amount of undiscovered stuff is dropping off a cliff real quick, because like everything has been posted once. Everything has been bumped into once. There's, you know, there's always hikers who spend their, there's like mountaineer guides, hiking guides, locals who spend their entire lives going in and out of the forest. And they've seen a lot of this stuff that's undiscovered. And when they're walking around with smartphones, at some point, someone's going to snap a picture of it and it's going to be out there on the internet. But I still consider those things to be undiscovered, at least until someone in the scientific community or Herpa world gets their hands on it.
Yeah. So out of curiosity, what's been your experience with Boiga?
Oh, I've seen a lot of Boiga, a huge amount of Boiga. If you're asking about like their venom or ecology?
Whichever one you want to talk about.
A lot of people have this like, we get people coming out to Southeast Asia and they're always asking, oh, what's the venom on these like? Because like Boiga are quite well known to be rear fang venomous species. And I'll shed a really, really important bit of information for people who may be listening when it comes to rear fangs, especially those in Southeast Asia, is there is a lot of rear fang venomous snakes in Southeast Asia, which can have adverse effects if you are envenomated. But it's very, very easy to not be envenomated by these species because all of them rely on the same delivery system. It's biting and then chewing on you and massaging the venom in over a sustained period of time. And if you don't let a snake chew on you for more than 20, 30 seconds, especially more than a minute, especially up to 2 minutes, you'll be fine. You'll really be fine. That just, if a rear fang snake bites you, just gently pry it off. You know, if you can easily learn these techniques of just gently peeling a snake off without harming it, remove it quickly, you will be fine. The only people I ever known who'd had ill of adverse effects from bites from these kind of species, let them chew on them for a sustained period of time, either because they thought it'd be interesting, they didn't care, or they didn't want to hurt the snake by like pulling it off, right? And even in these cases, most of these rear fang venomous species cannot have severe effects, not like front fang venomous snakes, on humans. There's a very few species which can, and that's mainly the Rhabdophis genus, especially Rhabdophis siamensis, Rhabdophis helleri, the redneck keelback group, and Rhabdophis tigrinus in China. Those are the two which are 100% confirmed, including recent cases of you'll need severe treatment in hospital. Like you will be extremely effed up if one of those chews on you for 2 minutes straight. But if one of those bites you, you are totally fine. You are totally fine. If it nips you, if it bites you and you remove it afterwards, you will be okay. They have to spend at least 30 seconds. I'm being very generous here as well. I'm being like as conservative as possible, I guess the best way to put it. They need to chew on you for at least 30 seconds in order for venom to really do anything beyond create like very mild swelling around the bite site.
Yeah. And what species of Boiga have you seen? I'm guessing you've seen the iconic mangroves and Cynodon. I'm guessing those two off right off the bat.
Yeah, I've seen a lot. I haven't seen like really any bulgogi I consider to be like special. I've seen all the ones in Thailand. I've seen what's the one? Guangxiensis, bulgogi Guangxiensis in Laos. Only a couple records of that one from Laos. That was quite a cool snake to find there. I believe that one to be in Thailand, just waiting to be discovered somewhere. Maybe one day we'll go look for that. And I've seen some in the Philippines as well. A couple like interesting ones there. I've never seen the really crazy Luzon one, you know, divergence, but we get Dendrophila divergence with the blue bands as well as the yellow and black. It's a pretty special snake, that one. That's one we really want to get out and look for one day. But yeah, Bouyga, I'm not too big of a fan of Bouyga. I mean, I love all snakes, especially larger snakes. Those big colubrids, they're very cool, but they're quite easy to find. We find them a lot at night, and hopefully one day I can see more of the Philippines, like endemic ones, which I haven't seen too many of yet.
Yeah. If I had to go over to Southeast Asia, I would just want to get at least one photograph of a mangrove. I know it's like baby's first Southeast Asian snake, but still.
Oh yeah, yeah. You can sort that out, no problem, man. That's like one of the few snakes which can be quite abundant in its microhabitat. So slow flowing jungle streams, the mangrove cat snake is a common species, one of the most common species in those areas. That's it. Around like KL, don't see them too often for whatever reason. Parts of Peninsula Malaysia, they're not like, but certain areas in southern Thailand, I'm talking, they are 100% guaranteed. Like there's a swamp forest we know in southern Thailand. I'm telling, like, we've never been there and not seen four of them swimming around the swamp. So,
and do those guys get it over to Borneo or any other islands?
They're everywhere in the tropical part of Southeast Asia, like everywhere in the tropical area. They're even in Cambodia. Which is so strange, but yeah, they're everywhere. The Borneo one is super common as well. The Philippine one, and some of the Philippine ones, Palawan, etc., are really, really common.
Yeah. Is there a particular genera of snake that you haven't seen that you really want to see?
I don't think too many like genera which include like encompass a lot of individuals. There's obviously like some genera which have just like one or two individuals within that, which I haven't seen, like Xenophidion, which is the spiny jawed snakes. There's a species in Peninsula Malaysia. There's a species in Borneo. And there's a undescribed one in Sumatra. I'd love to see one of those one day. That would be an absolute dream come true. That's another ridiculously rare group. Like KL, the funny thing is they're most common around KL. That's like their hotspot. But even then, we've got three records in the last 20 plus years, something like that, maybe more. Three records in God knows how much time there. So very, very, very. And, it's people going out herping every day in KL. So,
yeah. Now I think of that, we haven't really talked about any of the elapids, Southeast Asian elapids, other than the crates. What's been your experience with elapids in and around that corner of the world?
I love elapids. I like all snakes, and I like snakes which are flashy and showy. So
I've got to say those redhead crates.
That's my favorite snake. Whenever people ask me what's your favorite snake, I always say redheaded crate, because it's just the absolute embodiment of perfection in like serpent form. It's huge. They get to 2 meters. They're built like really strong and powerful. A really, really striking, yet also like very aesthetically appealing color scheme, with the jet black and the bright red head and tail, bright orange head and tail, and they're highly venomous. And to make things even better, they're one of the most docile snakes you'll ever encounter. So they're like everything I like about snakes wrapped up into one, basically. So that's why I always say it's my favorite. But I've seen some great ones, like Slowinski's crate. We're always arguing amongst me and my friends of which one's better, like redheaded crate or Slowinski's crate. I think they're really biased because Slowinski's crate is rarer. At least to us, it is rarer. Let's just say the truth, it's a lot rarer, like significantly rarer. But that one's crazy. It's built really similar to the banded crate, like a really big, broad head with the stubby tail, and it has like the white V shape on the head and the really like the spotted bands through the body. And the fact that lives in like those high montane areas and it's so elusive, like turbo giga clouted snake, that's one of my favorites as well. I want to see Calliophis salatan, this Dinagat Island coral snake in the Philippines. And while a lot of coral snake, this is the second largest coral snake, right, in Southeast Asia. It's not that much smaller than Bivigata. Like Bivigata is giant compared to the others, but this one gets to a substantial size. It only occurs, as far as we know, in this extremely remote island in the Philippines, and it looks great. So it looks like a Malayan crate. So it's black and white banded with very broad bands on the upper, and it just has this bright, bright red tail, like a red-headed crate or a blue coral snake. And that's like one of the elapids that not many people even know exists, you know? Not many people even know that one exists. There's only two photographs of living specimens ever, living individuals, and I need to find that one. That's very high on my list. The only problem is that island is just so difficult to get to, and it takes so much time, and it's so much time dedicated to that area, and it costs a lot of money. So it's just like, I need to find the willpower to go back there. I'll do it next year.
Yeah. What about the Naja species in and around there?
Yeah, there's a lot of cool Naja. I'm not a huge fan of cobras. They're very like generic snakes to me. And you know, they're incredibly popular and most of them are pretty common. But that doesn't mean I don't like finding them. I think catching a cobra is one of the most exciting things that you can have happen at any time while you're herping. You know, just, you know, it's a cobra. They hood up, they make loud noises at you. It's just absolute greatness, isn't it? It's excitement. Yeah. I had a lot of like good fortune with cobras recently. Caught a few big Sumatran cobras, special ones in Peninsula Malaysia. I've seen a lot of cobra species actually in Southeast Asia. I've seen most of them, in fact. I think I'm just missing Naja philippensis, the North Philippine one. I've seen like every single other species of cobra now. I saw Samarensis in January, which, you know, you're familiar with that one, the black and gold one.
Samarensis, maybe.
Yeah, type that in, Naja Samarensis. Look that up. That's a special snake, I'm telling you.
Samar cobra?
Yeah.
Ooh, that is pretty.
Yeah, we're doing an expedition like targeting that one for Explore Herpetology in January to Davao, because they're actually really common in the city. And if you know the right places to look, you can almost guarantee to turn them up, and they are stunning. Like the black and gold combination, the ones in Davao are like not so much like the ones in captivity. The ones in captivity are really, really yellow in color with a few black markings, whereas the ones in Davao are like black is the base color. And every time they breathe, they ripple yellow through the body. And of course, the head and neck and everything is bright, bright yellow.
Oh, so you see like the interscalation yellow, just it kind of flow down the body whenever they inhale.
I've got video of it. It ripples down the body. When they breathe, it's like the yellow just ripples down the body every time. Absolutely stunning. But they're a piece of work, I'm telling you. They are spitting cobras who are
That makes things difficult.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't even we wore our goggles when, obviously we didn't at night, because spitting cobras, they can't really hit your eyes at night because they can't see, especially if you're wearing a headlamp. But when we got it out in the daytime, because we wanted to look at it in the day, we got the goggles on, like all of us straight away. After like 2 minutes, we took them off. We realized that it's not spitting at our faces. It's just too distracted by our boots and the camera lenses and stuff like that.
Yeah. Wow. A cobra species that has its own theme song too.
You know, the spitting cobras in Southeast Asia for the most part are pretty lame, like in terms of their spitting ability. There's a little bit of like discussion. Some people have said that some Samar cobra localities are insanely good at spitting compared to others. Our friend his Facebook is like Mindanao Herping Honza. He's like a guy who lives in the Philippines, like a guy.
I'm gonna look him up right now. So
yeah, Herping Honza. He claims that the ones from Davao, like the locality that we go to, are the worst spitters of all of them. And other localities where he catches them quite a lot, he says they can hit you right in the eye from those areas. And I wouldn't like generalize too much. For the most part, the spitters I encounter in Southeast Asia are not very accurate whatsoever. And only really big ones who are very like alert and can identify your eyes in the daytime, they're the only ones you really need to worry about.
Okay.
Yeah.
I remember something I was going to ask about the rear fangs, but I don't know if they're even really venomous, but kukri snakes, that's something I probably don't want to get bitten by.
Nah, I'm more scared of those than I am like most other snakes in Southeast Asia, man. The little ones I don't mind too that much, but some of the big ones like purpura sens, the purple kukri, the fasciolatus, I think it's small banded kukri is a common name, and some of the other like larger ones from Southeast Asia, they are genuinely scary. Like, I've seen people drip blood. Like, Keith got bitten by one while he was trying to like grab it behind the neck. This guy was covered the road in blood. I'm talking like the road was absolutely drenched. We had to wrap his hand up like crazy. Oh man. But I'm telling you, there's other snakes in Southeast Asia you need to watch out for as well. This is going to blow your mind, but there's this huge genus. We call them reed snakes. These tiny little worm-like snakes called Calamaria is the genus, right? Calamaria is the genus name. And those guys are specialized. They have specialized teeth made for tearing apart earthworms, right? And if they get you, they grab your finger, massage their teeth in until these ultra-sharp serrated teeth, and they twist until they rip off a chunk of flesh. And I have been torn up so badly by these that I was like, literally, again, I remember I caught it on the road when we started herping, got bitten by it on the road. When we drove back down the road several hours later, my blood was still staining the pavement. There was like a huge pool of blood just from a snake that was maybe just a few inches long.
Dang. Just a few inches long. Even in Southeast Asia, even the garter snakes have lethal equipment.
Yeah. Those guys are way tinier than garter snakes. We're talking like tiny worm-like snakes, and so many people have fallen victim. Like, everyone in Southeast Asia who herps regularly will tell you a story of when they let their guard down. And one of my snake bags that I bring around is actually stained with blood, and it's from a calamaria, a different species of calamaria as well.
And you said this thing basically tears apart earthworms, right?
Yeah. If it can't fit the earthworm like inside its whole body, it just rips off like whatever chunk it can fit. It just grabs it, twists, rips off the part of the earthworm, eats it. Yeah.
So it does a full-on crocodile death roll.
Yes, exactly. Exactly that. Yeah, and it will do that on you if you piss it off too much. Dang. This is one on Borneo where we go. It's called Calamaria heleniusi, Helenius's reed snake. That one has the sharpest. He's got kukri snake teeth, because one time it didn't even bite me. All it did was it tried to bite me as I like pulled my hand away, scratched down my finger, just sliced me right open like a kukri snake, just as razor sharp, like huge teeth in its mouth.
Huh.
I know like this guy, Kurt, who does also like herping tours in Malaysia and Borneo. He has a scar from like 10 years ago from that exact species.
Dang. Yeah. That sounds like the only snake I can think of off the top of my head that will actually dismember prey species, because I can't think of any other snake that doesn't swallow its prey whole.
Oh, I can name a couple. There's the one that I told you earlier that I found after like 10 plus years of looking for it, the Gongylosa melongacauda. That one eats spiders, and it just tears the abdomen off spiders. It just grabs the abdomen, twists until it pulls the abdomen off, eats the abdomen, and discards the rest of the body.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm sure there's more snakes. Oh, I know. I got another one as well. There's another super obscure. You probably never heard of the genus. It's Opistrotropis. It's like an aquatic mountain stream snake genus from northern Indochina. They eat freshly molted crabs, and they tear off the limbs one by one and eat them. Yeah. There's some video, and there's a paper about that, about their feeding mechanism. Yeah, and I think maybe... Yeah, they do. They tear them apart limb by limb. Yeah, quite a few snakes who will who really like treat their prey like a Sunday roast dinner.
Or, yeah, it gives a whole new meaning to a crab boil, but... All right, so one question I did want to ask before... I don't know how much longer you want to go, but one question I did want to ask.
Yeah, if we can wrap up in like 10, 20 minutes, that would be fantastic. I got to get up so early tomorrow.
Yeah. One question I definitely want to make sure to ask was, do you have any advice for reptile-focused content creators?
That is a good question. My suggestion would be like to focus on... production value would be really good. So make sure you're filming with a like decent camera where you can, and make sure you at the bare minimum have a good light that you can light stuff with, and make sure you show the animal well to the audience. And from that point, you're already off to a start. You're already starting at a level which is above most people in the game. And that will include me as well. If you learn like good production quality, good filming, you could jump ahead of me in terms of that very, very quickly. The difference is that I focus on the searching and finding animals part as my the main thing, the production quality comes second, because I don't film. I film opportunistically. That's the truth. I'm not a YouTube is not my main thing. It's one of my like side products and like products. And I just try to fit that in with the other stuff I do, which means production quality cannot come first to me. But if you want to get into content creation, I'd say like looking at production quality, making sure you have good audio, and just generally look into a bit of like editing techniques and stuff like that will take you a really long way.
All right. All right. And finally, where can people find you?
Rupert's Reptiles on Instagram, Rupert's Reptiles on YouTube. Those are the only two that matter.
All right. And with that, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, man. It was great to talk. Thanks.